All right, so we're going right into the many raised hands, and Ivan's going to bring the microphone to you. And I'm glad you're interested in talking to each other, so let's join.
Okay, so
that's yours. Right there. All right, so those hands that I didn't get to who feel outraged, please. Eleanor's
first talking.
I'm okay. Eleanor once.
Okay.
Okay.
Hello?
Okay. Sorry.
All right, Eleanor, go ahead. Speak loudly and forcefully. And
hello?
Yes, okay.
Quiet sit side. Oh, sorry. What I was thinking was I just wanted to tell two stories, not about psychoanalysis killing itself, but killing creativity. And I'm interested in this in terms of Fairbairn seeing achievement of identity.
Tell one story, and then we'll come back to you later.
Oh, do you want the story first? It's the separation identity process. And I know Frances Tustin said to me at one stage, she said, Tavistock's recognizing me now. But when I was there, I used to go to bed thinking my husband likes me and my analyst likes me. And Bowlby said to me, if I hadn't done my work on hospital, I would have been politically dead.
Yeah.
And this was real. And in some sense, I'm interested in it because I think it's, patient is a closed system. We dissolve that. People can't give it up because it's a self in a desert. And in some sense, why is there a failed analysis that people keep clinging to the identity of a father who's not allowed to move? Why can't they ever individuate?
Good. Okay, thanks.
Why do they attack the dissenter?
I wonder if it has to do with the bad object. It's fascinating to me that we get to the Holocaust all around the world except in Japan and in the East. And I wonder, as peace negotiators talk about humiliation, I wonder if we're terrified of humiliating each other, but more importantly, annihilating each other professionally, within the profession and from profession to profession. Then the other thing I want to say is, Moreno used to say, if God ever comes back, he'll come back as a group. And the other thing I want to say is we as a profession have an occupational hazard of pathologizing each other. And I think that's difficult in our organizations. And the other thing is somebody here said that their little grandchild said to them, Grandma, I'm going to miss myself when I grow up, which I thought was a lovely thing. And I wonder if we grow up professionally from many, many aspects of mental health, the third thing might be our dialectic instead of competition and so on, what we can create together, give to each other and take from each other. And that's maybe the third thing. I don't know.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. I think we are going to have this session as a general overall.
Yeah.
So any thoughts about any of the papers? All the speakers are here, hopefully. So you can pick on any you like.
And the ones that aren't here are especially fair game.
Absolutely, yeah, of course. Those people, they absolutely.
Thank you. Xiao Chunxing from China. And I fly 12 hours just to attend this meeting and also visit my daughter who is studying at Oxford. And before I came, I read a book about Fairbairn in China. There's only half a book contributed to his theory because another half of the book is for Berlin. I don't know his given name, sorry. And then I read a chapter in English in a book, Object Relation and Self-Psychology. And that's my basic knowledge about this author. When I came here and I attend all the round of this conference, I realized that in China, the scholars or the field of psychoanalysis, they missed a significant part of the legacy of Fairbairn. So, but when I compare the Chinese edition and the English edition of the work of Weber, there is something missed. And then when I came here, I know there are more. So that's part of my gain from this conference. And next thing is, you know, China is a developing country. We experienced fast growth rate, and that caused lots of social problems. And just when I came, before I came here, several days, there's a terrible thing happened in Kunming City. Some Muslim, five Muslim killed 27 Chinese people in 25 minutes in a railway station. So that's maybe some reasons just discussed in these hours about something of collective identification. So I really hope psych analysis can be widely spread in China. And then I'm here because I'm going to set up my own business in my local town. Nanjing is 1 hour train trip to Shanghai. And psychodynamic psych therapy is very poorly accepted by people because it's slow and it's energy demanding. So I really hope to get more people know this field and can be involved in the training or something like learning or knowledge and other evidence-based experiences. So
let me speak to you directly. So please stay afterwards and make contact with me because Jill and I... And
do you want to say some more about...
Sorry?
Do you want
of course, we want more. I have been going to China where we actually have... There is a growing group of people who think psychoanalysis is quite wonderful and who really want to learn it. It's small compared to the need, but it's actually one of the places we should all go because they like us. And we have been doing training in Beijing and with students from all around China. They really do care, and a lot more books are being translated. And I think you're absolutely right. Fairbairn is under-recognized, although a number of our books have been translated, and they're all based on Fairbairn. So I wish you'd spoken earlier so we could learn more from you, but I hope this will just be a beginning for you. Okay, so let's take some more.
Joe Schwartz from the Bowlby Center. I wanted to quote something from Marilyn French, the novelist, who says in the women's room that you can't get justice, but you can get love. And I think that theme was hit upon in the last session. And what bothers me is, what are we going to do about that? Either as clinicians or men and women.
If I say something, when Stephen was speaking about love and justice, I thought a quote came into my mind from Ernest Jones, who isn't normally regarded as somebody who's on the love side. And the quote is that a child needs love for its mental development just as it needs food for its physical development. And this is Ernest Jones, you know, but that recognition, obviously, that we need love doesn't then translate into that psychoanalysis is about love. Or, you know, so the recognition has to be there, but then Stephen might say, well, but the technique of analysis and how it operates is on a different level. I don't know how the clinicians would think about that.
Hi, Sharma Prasad from University of Edinburgh. I was just interested to know what your thoughts were regarding individual and collective identity and social media such as Twitter and Facebook.
Uh-huh. wrong view.
Is that for me?
I think
for Jill.
Yeah.
That's tough.
I haven't really thought much at all about that kind of a question, although it's clear that social media is kind of connecting people, but the question is how, you know, I guess it can, there are certain parts of the social media I'm not so familiar with that I imagine can contribute to a person's sense of identity. And what that means, given that it's a kind of a virtual space or, you know, in that world, I'm not sure. If it begins, like there was that movie, Her, recently or something like that. I guess a guy fell in love with a voice on the internet or if, I understand. So it can affect us. And if it begins to impact our self-concept, then it can, make a difference in terms of, you know, just our behavior, our perception of the world around us. But in terms of kind of gathering people to then have an impact on society, that's a different thing. You know, there's the groups that we're talking about, the one thing that didn't come up in our conversation that also is relevant for psychoanalytic institutes and this kind of a question is leaders. And so there's a group, and without leaders, they don't galvanize. Leaders also give rationalizations about how to act or how to treat others. And that kind of propaganda, which then can fuel certain behaviors too. So leadership is vital no matter what kind of collective identity we're talking about.
Yeah, Julia.
More specific, technically, I want a technical question. I had a referral from an American analyst rather recently. And when I asked the patient who'd moved to London to come and see me, there was a long pause. He'd been in treatment for 5 years and had never seen his analyst. And it had done entirely over the Skype, I suppose. And furthermore, the analyst was variously in and out of America. And I must say, it troubled me enormously. So on the one hand, I'm open to it. I have a patient who can't speak to me in the session, quite a new patient, but texts me wonderful dreams. And I've struggled with this thought and indeed have started to respond to the dreams. But of course, some of my colleagues support me and some clearly don't. But I think we have to be thoughtful about it. The consequence of the social media connects people, but it also inhibits their capacity to meet face to face. And some terrible things get done on the media. I mean, the damage to some of our patients from the media is hard to describe comprehensively. So I just think we need to be very thoughtful about it. The pressure for Skype analysis is something that needs thoughtfulness. We don't know quite how to deal with it.
Jim?
That's the sort of thing that I might say at some point.
Go ahead.
But
go ahead.
Just brief.
The social media is a new social object that we didn't have 20 years ago. Young people are not only born into it, they live in it. And it's changing our concepts of privacy and of identity. Young people, they actually will play with various identities. I mean, this recalls Fairbairn's view of the multiple selves in interaction within the personality. Social media gives a way for expressing these different selves, but in a way in which you don't actually have to be accountable for them, which I echo what Julian's saying here. It's quite frightening how much damage can be done to people anonymously. The kind of bullying that used to occur in school where witnesses knew who the bully was, even if they did nothing about it. On the internet now it's anonymous. And talk about justice, very hard to get it on behalf of those victims. That said, there's also a tremendous opportunity that's offered by the new telecommunications to create a very large interest group. You're saying, I mean, how can psychoanalysis reach out beyond itself? Obviously, it has to be using social media. And I, and most people like me, do not want to use it. Don't want to be on Facebook, are paranoid about Facebook. Don't want to be on LinkedIn. Don't want to do Twitter. But how ideas are spreading is through being posted and then reposted and then tweeted and retweeted. And thus a large group develops. It's a new way of developing a group compared to, for instance, being a member of the International Psychoanalytic Association, for instance, and expressing your political aims through whatever political activity it will engage in, which is, as I think you'll agree, not much.
Jim? Well, I was going to change the subject.
Well, I think that's fair. I mean, this is sort of a plenary session about the whole weekend, not just about what this new social space we're embedded in, which is terribly important.
Exactly. Well, I realized that when we began this segment, at 4 o'clock, I was very full of the ideas from the set of presentations, right? But then I started thinking about the whole conference, realizing how many different perspectives we have heard about Fairbairn. And some of them, they're not all internally consistent, right? There are some of us who have different perspectives, and if we really got down to the presuppositions underneath it, we'd realize that we were reading into Fairbairn something that was actually contradictory. And I was thinking that 50 years from now, you know, there may be the classic Fairbairnians, there may be the Scharfian Fairbairnians, and there may be the anti-libidinal ego psychologists. And I was thinking, how do we prevent that? You know, what state do we need to be in to prevent differences from becoming reified, right? Hypostasized as something that becomes a marker of the in-group and the out-group. And this is not that easy, right? There's something about wisdom. There's something about truth. There's something about recognizing that one thing can be many things to many people. And to be able to hold that all in mind is not an easy task. It's sort of an advanced human being that's able to do that. But so it strikes me that maybe in a conference like this, we see the possible birth of the differentiation into groups, and it's something to think about right now about how to hold some sort of wall against that.
Yeah, I was going to say two things really, one about the media, the book. That is the occasion for this conference, and this conference would not have happened, could not have happened, without emails, PDFs, et cetera, the internet, and so on and so forth, because I sat in the garden shed doing my bit of editing, and David was wherever he was in the world, and we were communicating with each other. Most of the people who contributed to this book I'd never met in person before this happened, so that's an aspect of...
Same is true of the conference.
And the conference, too.
Ivan before. No. And why he signed on by email, it must be crazy.
The other thing was that you just talked about being full up and having digestive problems, as it were, with the sheer quantity. It reminded me of the meal we had last night where the food just kept on coming and coming and coming, and I needed to go away and lie down in a darkened room to begin to digest, metabolize what's happened. And that's how I feel about the conference now. And the two things that I'm going to take away, two most important things for me at the moment that I'm going to take away, is the continuing discussion about the good object, being clear about where that is, but also this idea of the big O, the large group in the head, and what something that Gal Gerson talked about, which was a Hegelian notion of the nation, and the degree to which he thought Fairbairn in his thoughts about the war neuroses and child abusers was opting for a sort of a Hegelian nation attitude as opposed to what he called the sort of mainstream object relations viewpoint. So those are things that are still in my mind, and I'm still sort of trying to think about and trying to draw comparisons with. But like I said, I'm in need of a dark room.
Well, I'm thinking about here with a few minutes to go. What we've had in this afternoon is this sort of enormous expansion into a much larger space of thought, and thrown this 3 days of exposure, of intensive exposure to many, but not all, of Fairbairn's ideas. But it really has to be embedded in the larger social discourse if it's going to be useful. So we've been saying, okay, it's underappreciated. It's at least a major influence, we agree, of modern psychoanalytic thought in a very diverse and broad way. But if it's going to continue to be a useful group of thoughts, it has to be refreshed by encounters with very much different ideas, especially if it's going to be useful in the broader social understanding.
Some people.
Yeah, in the back. Let's see who it is, but it's in the back.
Thanks. My name's Keith Bibby. I'm nothing to do with you, and I'm everything to do with you. In that I'm an Ericksonian psychotherapist. One or two people have kindly inquired what that signifies. I just say Google Milton Erickson, and you'll find out something really interesting. But I just want to utter a couple of heresies. And one is, I heard someone say earlier that psychoanalysis is the guardian of the language. And I thought, that's funny. I thought we Ericksonians were that. Well, of course, it's rubbish, isn't it? Actually, yeah, we do have facility with language, and that's precious. Now, I was listening to Radio 4 on Friday evening after the first exciting little episode here, and there was a fascinating broadcast on a little episode called Forethought. And the speaker was a lad who originated in a real sink housing estate who was remarkably articulate. And he said he had aspirations to be a professor of paleontology at Oxford. Whether he was or not, I don't know. But that gives you some idea of the caliber of his aspiration. But he gave a profound insight into the difficulties of someone who's got qualities that set them outside. And he had to be tattooed. He had to have wire stuff stuck through his nose. He had to learn, after he'd been beaten up with batons and stuff like that, he had to learn to be brutal and criminal and take drugs and things like that to survive. Now, the amazing thing about this person was his account was incredibly articulate, true, and deeply moving. And what I thought was, you know, people like this need to be given a voice. And I was talking with someone over lunchtime, and here's the other heresy. I was saying that psychoanalysts, and actually I would say psychotherapists in general, have no idea about stress testing models. Yeah, we can create models, but actually they operate in limited context under special circumstances. But actually, what we need to do is to challenge ourselves by introducing real experience from the real world and seeing if we've got anything at all relevant or cogent to say about it. I think that's the proper way to test our models.
Well, I notice as a feature of our ending here, there's a kind of re-entry into the wider world from Milton Erickson to Nanjing and God knows where else. So a broader world of ideas that we have to not just compete in, but we have to be relevant to.
Was this person in therapy with, was it?
In all honesty, I would say he was in no need of therapy at all.
Yeah.
And I would like to add something to that. My name is Jo Robertson, and I'm a psychoanalytic therapist who works in the East End. And I'm in the fortunate position of not having a mortgage. Therefore, I can offer extremely cheap therapy. And I think for me, this conference, which was so incredibly important in terms of providing me with insights often from people who were talking to what actually happens to individuals in the outside world, not least Valerie Sinison, Anne Alvarez, and it really, particularly Anne Alvarez, making adjustments to the theory based on her experience of, and it struck me as a very important word, this rectification word, and the notion that some experiences can be so bad because the outside world is so terrible to the people having children that the child has nothing inside, the futility notion. Now, I'd like to just connect that, if I could. I used to be on a clinic for, well, a couple of clinics, as it happens, but one of them for a psychoanalytic institute. And I can remember a quite well-known person wrote an assessment for a patient. And I had not been there for the previous meeting, but when the assessment came back, I did, in fact, managed to see the person, the therapist the assessment was sent to. And she said to me she was astonished when she found the patient arriving at her door to discover the person was black. It had not been mentioned in the assessment. Now, I think this notion of the real and the symbolic and the imaginary can be extremely interesting. But I think it can also completely stop us from understanding that an awful lot of things are real these days, too.
Thanks. Norca, let's just take a last comment from Norca, who really was so instrumental in getting the whole conference going.
Thank you. Well, I feel that I have to say this. We're at the Anna Freud Center, and if you look at those pictures there, you know, that was the outside world. You know, that was the war. And Anna Freud had serious, I'm at Yale now, and it never ceases to amaze me the impact of her work on the best interests of the child and how it has been forgotten. I work a lot in child welfare, and I keep trying to bring it back. But, you know, most of the people from my generation that graduated from this place are not in their consulting room. They are outside. They're in the outside world. They're working outside in the community. And so I think because of that, we continue to have a dialogue to take what we learned here, which we were lucky that was very clear and yet very innovative, because if you've ever looked at the developmental lines, you know, it has encapsulated in it the centrality of object relations, even though it has the psychosexual stages in it. But, you know, if you have a minute to look at Anna Freud's work, which it was is a little bit of an unsung hero too, you know, because she had a very big personality to sort of compete against. So, you know, she had an impact on the law, education, hospitals, you know, and I think that is really important, you know, and I think it's wonderful. I think she, I don't know, I was trained by her students, not her, but I think it's wonderful that we could have this weekend here. And a couple of my friends that didn't come to the conference were standing for moral support on Friday here. And I have to tell you that they were, you know, grieving that we didn't have more exposure to this kind of thinking in our training. So, you know, well, more than one conversation.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting and us to do the book.
That, well, that just reminds me that we ought to thank the Anna Freud Center as well for hosting us here. And And, you know, now perhaps, you know, you can say the last words to the editors of the book.
And Grant says I should. Well, I think it's fitting because Norca and Joan Raphael-Leff's invitation to Graham, and Graham's generously including me in on the book, has led to this, including this wonderful weekend of sharing, and I think of really trying to locate Fairbairn's work in a world that he wanted to be relevant to in many, many ways, not just to the individual patient, although that was his laboratory and on which he learned so much, but to ideas about war and social difference and all these kinds of things. And I think it's quite wonderful that this divide, which could not be crossed 40 years ago, that the Anna Freud Center, the Hampstead Clinic, and the Tavistock would not speak to each other. And here we are. And it's really quite wonderful. Thank the four of you for joining us and enlarging our vision. And thank all of you for coming. And Graham, thank you.
Thank you. It's been great.
I've been thanking you.